Hello and welcome to Knit Spirit. I'm your host, Ivy Reisner, and this is episode 84, Perfect Justice and Perfect Mercy. I hope everyone had a wonderful holiday and a fantastic new year. I overdid it for the holiday knitting, and my wrist sort of gave me that little warning twinge, so I stopped for about a week, and it was better after that. I did entwined. I did the Yarn Harlot's unoriginal hat. I'm in love with your unoriginal hat. I just picked up like 8 ounces of bulky weight yarn because I realized I do not have any bulky weight yarn in stash. And I just want to do this pattern over and over again. When I did it the first time, I had 2 skeins of Cascade 220 and I just worked them together. I wound them together on my ball winder. I did a hat that I'm calling the Just Because You Can hat. That was that mitered hat I was talking about last time. The pattern is on my website. I basically cast on 3 stitches, worked increasing on every other side until I got to the hypotenuse I wanted. Basically, I was trying to do a square, so I was working it to a triangle and then working it back again. Switched colors. I was going between black and white, which is why everyone at my office now calls this the soccer ball hat. Switched colors and then decreased it down to 3 and bound off. I did 5 of them, sewed them together, and it worked out to a cute little cap. My boss saw it and he wanted it. So he wanted it a little bit longer. So I picked up around the hat and I started working some ribbing to give it a little extra length. But when I bound it off a little bit tightly so that it would fit snug. I forgot he has these massive dreadlocks. So now I have to loosen it. I have to take the bind off edge off and do Elizabeth Zimmerman's sewn bind off to make it really, really stretchy so he can fit it on. Or I may just give this one to the other coworker who wanted it and knit him his. But we shall see. I'm actually surprised at how well it went over because I thought it was kind of funky, you know, that whole black and white thing and squares sewn together, but a number of people have asked for it, and I may end up doing more of them. I finished the Sunday swing socks, and the photos are available on my blog. I had a lot of fun with that pattern, and I restarted Lizard Ridge, and now I'm addicted. I can't get away from, I think this is what got my wrist, I can't get away from Lizard Ridge. I finished a quarter of the blanket in about a week. I'm just in love with it. I had one odd moment with it on Christmas Eve. I had some eggnog. It was a pre-mixed kind in the bottle, and it had some whiskey in it. And I had never had whiskey before. This is new to me. I've gotten into whiskey. And the drunk feeling wore off, but I must have still been drunk because I couldn't count. The pattern starts with cast on 43 stitches. I cast on 45, 42, 44, anything but 43. I couldn't hit 43. Then at one point you purl 19 and you start the short row stuff. I purl 20, 17, any such number, but couldn't hit 19. Counting wasn't happening. I gave up. I put the thing down. Instead, I finished reading Mr. Darcy Vampire. Now, Mr. Darcy Vampire, by the way, is a really fantastic book. It's by Amanda Grange. She does a lot of the Jane Austen sequels. I think the only other one she has for Pride and Prejudice is Mr. Darcy's Diary. But this one is a lot of fun. It's clean. It's sweet. It's very much a game of wink, wink, nudge, nudge with the audience. Because of the title, you know Mr. Darcy's vampire. But Elizabeth Bennet doesn't know this. And the game is that the whole gambit of vampire lore is brought in. The cross, how impossibly beautiful vampires are, the eternal life, how they have memories of things that happened centuries ago, all this stuff. But it's all presented in a way that Elizabeth doesn't catch on. Like, in one line, she has somebody say to Darcy, "You know how our kind are hunted." But Elizabeth thinks immediately of the French Revolution and how the aristocracy were hunted. And it makes totally good sense why she would think this. I just had a good time with this book. It was surprising. I really didn't expect it to be nearly as good as it was. Jane mentioned that she had a problem thinking in cable. She finally learned how to think in cable. And I never really understood it that way. I've always heard of it as reading the pattern. But I kind of started to jive to it when I tried to do Lizard Ridge. The first time I tried, I had never experienced short row before. I'd never knit any socks or anything like that, which would take short row. So it confused me, and I ended up giving up on the first square, and I just did one of those wavy gravy hats instead. when I recently tried it, it was after knitting more socks than I care to admit to. And short row is just intuitive to me now. So I can totally, as it were, think in short row. I think that's one of the reasons that I'm addicted to this pattern is it was so hard the first time and is so incredibly simple now. And so obvious in how it works. But back then it was kind of mysterious. Even now I show the squares to people and I'm like, how did you do that? I'm entirely too much in love with Lizard Rich. Did you ever mentally link a pattern with something that was going on while you were knitting it? While I was working on the Yarn Harlot's unoriginal hat, my roommate was getting killed by a dragon. I'm getting killed by a dragon and getting killed by a dragon. We were off work and she would start the battle at like 8 o'clock in the morning. She'd boot up the game and just go beat up the dragon. And she'd keep pounding the thing till late at night, you know. Load the game. Walk into the tavern. Talk to the guy. Meet the dragon. Fight the dragon. Die by the hands of the dragon. Repeat from star all day long. Now understand, the game is Last Remnant, and the dragon battle sequence, it's a side quest, you don't have to go on it. But if you do, the dragon battle sequence has a music track behind it that's about 32 notes long. And it just repeats. So it's kind of like listening to a ringtone all day long. And I think knitting all day long was probably why my hands started to protest. But finally, at about 2 a.m. on the second day, she killed the stupid dragon. I thought this was the end of it. She said, wow, that was fun. Let's go kill it again. And now that hat is permanently linked in my head to slaying the dragon. I wonder if I'm going to start hearing the music next time I cast another one. I'm just hearing the music in my head. But getting back on topic, one discussion that often comes up is how can God show both perfect justice and perfect mercy? Aren't the two at odds? Maybe, but I think Aristotle holds the key to this one. In his work, The Nicomachean Ethics, he talks about finding the correct value ethic, the golden mean, as a point between two extremes in virtue, too much and too little. Now, I'm going to point out that philosophers who subscribe to the school of value ethics will also claim that justice and mercy are at odds. I'm going outside the normal scope here. But I think it works. Aristotle argued against an extreme of any one value, either too much or too little. Think of honesty. An extreme lack is a terrible liar. An extreme excess is someone who doesn't know when a white lie is appropriate and says hurtful things that shouldn't have been said. Take courage. An extreme lack is cowardice. An extreme amount of it, and overmuch of it, is foolhardiness. Aristotle lists 10 values. Courage, self-control, generosity, magnificence, high-mindedness, pride, gentleness, friendliness, truthfulness, and wit. Aristotle doesn't deal with justice right in the same way we mean it here. He's more concerned with people obeying the law than with people enforcing or writing it. So he claims that the law commands the other virtues. Ergo, social justice is virtue entire. Justice, in terms of consequences for action and recompense for wrongs done, has as its extremes, on the one hand, a total lack, which would mean no one ever suffered the consequences for their actions, no one ever received any restitution for any wrongs done to them. So someone gets hit by a car, drunk driver, too bad, so sad, deal with it. An excess of justice would mean that everyone must make restitution for every consequence of their wrong actions. So somebody double parks, a very small wrong action, and they must first make restitution to the state in punishment for violating the state's laws. That's your basic, they get a parking ticket. And they must make restitution for every person they delayed. Now, let's say the double parker delays a teenager from getting to her babysitting assignment. He makes restitution to her and to the person who hired her. Now, let's say she was hired by a man who normally works from home but needed to attend a meeting. Well, delaying her delays him and inconveniences everyone at the meeting who had to wait. Now, follow this all the way through. Does it having to leave the meeting late cause damage to someone else further down the road? He's got to make restitution for all of them. And now repeat this whole cycle for every single car delayed. That's an extreme of justice. A perfect value ethic of justice finds the appropriate middle ground that maximizes the good. Now, of course, mercy encompasses more than a moderating factor to justice. It can also mitigate cruelty. It can also be charity. It can also be kindness. But insofar as it is in conflict with justice, an extreme lack looks exactly like extreme justice. And extreme mercy looks exactly like an extreme absence of justice. Extreme mercy says everything is forgiven, no consequences, no problems, no punishments ever. Extreme lack means every possible consequence is piled on every action of every person. A perfect value ethic of mercy, or of this aspect of mercy, is finding the right middle ground. Now, God, being perfectly wise, knows the point where the middle ground of justice and the middle ground of mercy, the perfect value ethic of justice and the perfect value ethic of mercy, intersect. And it is that point of balance. It is from that point of being in a perfect value ethic of both from which he acts. Many people find it surprising that pride is a value in Aristotle's work. But think about it. Too little pride is that kind of lack of self-esteem that leads, say, a woman to stay with an abusive husband, that makes people not try new things because of the fear that they can't, that makes people become doormats. So you don't want a total lack of it. And of course, too much pride is arrogance. You want that perfect value ethic, that middle ground. That's what's going to work for a person. As a cute aside, apropos of totally nothing, Aristotle was against democracy. He claimed that if the many have power, they will take the wealth from the rich, who will, by definition, be few. He was contrasting it to the oligarchy system, which he said is also unjust, as it leads to tyranny. Eventually, you'll have one person who has more than anybody else, and he pretty much rules the state, and probably badly. In this, too, he sought a middle ground, but that's in his work called Politics. So, I may be way off base. If so, let me know. ivy@knitspirit.com. But I'm going to go knit some more lizard-rich squares. And until next time, be blessed and keep knitting.